amplifying, but I'll use my outdoor voice. Can we check to see if we're amplifying? I know we're recording, but we're on. All right. Today we have, so today is Wednesday, April the 14th. It's my daughter Amelia's fourth birthday. We have two confirmations, and then we have two bills that we want to hear, but votes will not be taken. For the record and for purposes of the two confirmations, we do have a quorum, and our first person on the agenda is Mr. William Egan.
Good afternoon.
I believe this is a reappointment. Is that correct, Mr. Egan?
Yes.
Members, the governor's notice of appointment should be in your packets. Mr. Egan has been reappointed as an attorney member to the Board on Judicial Standards. So tell us how you've liked it and why you want to go back on it.
Well, I've enjoyed the work quite a bit. It's been a lot more challenging than I thought it was going to be. But I feel it's an important public service, and I'd like to go back on the board because I was currently named the chair, and I don't really feel like I should be abandoning my post at this point in time. So I would ask the committee to reappoint me.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Egan? Senator Betzel?
And Mr. Egan, I think I may have expressed my concerns before. I've got a lot of respect for the work of the board. I do have some concerns about the executive director, and I just ask the board members to pay attention to the advice he's given to the judges, monitor his record keeping, you know, the files that he's got, and, you know, just ask questions of him, because I'm not quite sure that, you know, he serves the judicial branch as well as he could. So I just have some concerns about the executive director.
Yes, and we are required by rule to evaluate his performance annually, and we do that, and we have kind of revamped that process as of last year. So
thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Foley moves that this committee recommends that the appointment of William J. Egan as the attorney member to the Board on Judicial Standards be confirmed. Any
Madam
further discussion? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, Mr. Egan, you don't have any relatives in Anoka, do you?
I do not, Senator.
Okay.
Because I have a relative out there with your identical same name. And, so. But so be it. I would renew my motion.
Well, Linda Higgins is around, too.
Even though you're not related to Senator Foley, he renews his motion.
Right.
All those in favor signify
smooth,
by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And there is a Foley Boulevard in Coon Rapids, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And Ms. Jepson. And members, again, the notice of appointment is in your folders. I believe this is another reappointment.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Cindy Jepson. I, too, am up for confirmation on reappointment and have enjoyed the 4 years that I've already served on the board. The work is detailed, analytical. It's fascinating. The reading material comes by the volumes. In fact, this month it came in a box instead of a big mailing bag, but I really believe this is an important public service.
Any questions for Ms. Jepson?
And Madam Chair,
Senator
Ms.
Betzel?
Jepson, I'll just ditto what I said. Just keep close tabs on your executive director.
Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Senator Betzel moves that this committee recommends that the appointment of Ms. Jepson as the public member to the Board of Judicial Standards be confirmed. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Members, we are going to take up Senate File 3191. We're just going to try to get Senator Cohen is here. Senator Cohen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Welcome back.
I appreciate
you're setting aside committee time to listen to Senate File 3191. The bill is a proposal for a constitutional amendment for a state equal rights amendment. And I know that there's a lengthy agenda, so my intent is only to just make a couple of brief comments and then allow you to listen to the folks who have, I think, a very important perspective to bring to the committee on the issue. Just to set the stage, obviously, I think everybody knows that the federal proposal, which I believe was introduced sometime in the 1960s, was passed by the Congress, was never ratified by the states, came very close, but was not ratified. And my feeling was is that there that the issue should not go away and should not be ignored, that there were still significant things to be accomplished through an equal rights amendment, obviously at a state level, not a, I can't speak for the federal level. And so over the years, I've introduced the legislation at the start of each term. And I think I've done that since I came to the Senate. I can't remember in all honesty if I had done that previously to being in the House. And I had not sought a hearing prior to this. We were looking for a time that we thought would work best for the proposal. But I think it's an important issue, a very important issue, that this committee ought to consider. I recognize that we're past a deadline, so I'm not sure that consideration will be given in terms of placement on the ballot this year, but I hope certainly over the next couple of years there might be that opportunity. And just in terms of my interest, I think if you look at American history in the 20th century, you can make the argument that the most significant federal legislative efforts were possibly the 1935 Social Security Act, but I would also suggest the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And those two pieces of legislation obviously made a significant difference in what took place in the United States of America. And I think the ERA is a partner of that. And you know, as a legislature, as elected officials, we do a lot of things. We provide money for schools. We provide money for public safety. We work on roads. But I think there's nothing more intrinsic or inherent to what we ought to be doing as public officials than protecting human rights and civil liberties. And I think a state ERA goes a long ways toward doing that. So that's why I've continued to introduce this legislation, just feeling that even if it was not the time to pass it, it was an idea whose time had not passed. And you'll hear from the witnesses as to why that's the case. And again, Madam Chair, members, I appreciate your spending some time listening to people. So you've got a number of very significant witnesses who can offer a much better perspective than I can, and I'll sit here and listen with all of you as well.
Very good. Senator Cohen, thank you. You have been very diligent to this issue year after year, and I think we appreciate your being willing to introduce this bill year after year. So thank you for presenting the bill.
And Madam Chair, I just want to make one comment, and I actually think some of the witnesses will speak to it. I'm actually going to get away and just sit at the committee table if I might, if that's okay, and listen with all of you. But when the bill was drafted originally, it was drafted in the title as providing for sexual equality under the law. It should be equality of the sexes. Now, I understand that you're probably not going to take action today. I have an amendment to that. We don't need to adopt the amendment if members want to wait until there's actually action on the bill. But I do want to point out that that's a mistake in the title, and I do think that's going to be addressed as to why that is a qualitative difference as you hear the witnesses.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
And as I've been looking at it, and I've looked at this language for years, and I'm thinking that, the language should not be abridged or denied on account of gender as opposed to sex. It would be gender equality.
And Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, and that's why I think, Madam Chair, I won't speak for the chair of the committee, but I think that's why you wanted to have some testimony now to determine what language is appropriate for the bill, why it's appropriate, and allow us then to proceed from there.
Good. Thank you, Senator Higgins. Members, the other thing is that we did invite members who are our counterpart in the other body to come and join us. And today we have the House author, Representative Knuth, who has joined us. And she has also, on our behalf, extended an invitation to other members. So we might or might not have members from the other body joining us as the conversation proceeds. We have two testifiers at the table. Is it Professor Ms. Brennigan and is it Professor Stratton?
Actually, my name is Jill Galding.
Oh,
I'm here.
Professor Galding.
Together on behalf of Professor Stratton.
All right. So please proceed. Introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Chair Mao and members, my name is Jill Galding. I'm currently the co-director of the Workers' Rights Clinic at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I am also speaking today on behalf of the other co-director, Lisa Stratton, who was unable to attend. My general background lies in anti-discrimination law, which I've taught here in the U.S. and also studied overseas in Germany and the European Union. And over the years, I've also represented numerous individuals who have been seeking to enforce state and federal anti-discrimination laws. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today in favor of this bill. Before I begin my remarks, I actually want to comment briefly on the question that was raised about the wording of the bill, wording of the amendment, whether we should be talking about sex equality or gender equality. I think that question of wording can certainly be settled later, but I just wanted to mention that, in my view at least, the modern understanding or the modern usage of those terms means that they're essentially interchangeable. So in other words, equality of the sexes requires gender equality and vice versa. So another way to say that same thing is if we want to treat men and women equally, we have to treat them as individuals without imposing gender stereotypes on either sex. And so I'm going to be using both terms today somewhat interchangeably as well. As everyone has heard and as everyone, I think, knows, that the effort to pass a federal ERA ran aground in 1982, which is nearly three decades ago, which I think fairly raises the question, why do we need a Minnesota amendment now? And I think, as you'll hear from all the testimony today, the answer to that question is as multifaceted as the problem of inequality itself. But I'm going to review three main reasons. Number one, although we agree that men and women should be equal, that right is actually not legally guaranteed. Number two, we still need to guarantee equality legally because inequality persists in many forms in our community, and it hurts all of us. And finally, I think passing an equal rights amendment will reflect and reinforce Minnesota's leading role in the modern global economy. So, as to reason one, although we agree that men and women should be equal, that right is not legally guaranteed. I think we all know that there's no such provision in our state constitution, or we wouldn't be here today. There is no state ERA yet in Minnesota. More confusing, perhaps, is what level of protection exists under the federal constitution. People know that there's a clause in the federal constitution that guarantees equal protection, and that's certainly relevant to the question of gender equality. However, I think it's fair to argue that equal protection under the federal constitution is not really equal. In order to explain that, I need to explain the difference between some technical legal terms, one of which is something called intermediate scrutiny and one of which is called strict scrutiny. The 14th Amendment to the federal constitution guaranteed equal protection. However, that concept of equal protection has been interpreted differently depending on the right that's at stake. So a right to be free of race discrimination or a right that concerns other kinds of challenges to things that are considered fundamental rights get strict scrutiny, according to the court's interpretation of equal protection. And there's a legal gloss for that term. But basically what that means is we take those forms of discrimination and those rights very seriously indeed. Meanwhile, sex discrimination is treated less seriously. It gets only what the courts have called intermediate or sort of middle-level scrutiny. Now, why is strict scrutiny a better standard? I think I can give one example just through a case that's been decided under the intermediate scrutiny standard. That case is called Nguyen. It's a federal Supreme Court case. And basically what the court decided in that case is under the intermediate scrutiny standard, it's okay to require dads to prove that they love and care for their kids while moms don't have to prove that. And to understand what they were specifically deciding in that case, you have to know a little bit about the story. There was a dad, a father, a U.S. citizen, who was in Vietnam, had a child there, and cared for that child from the very beginning. He acted as that child's caretaker and parent. He brought the child with him when the child was young to the U.S., and they lived here for many years. Unfortunately, the child, who was a boy, got into some trouble and actually faced deportation, and that was the question at issue in the case. And what the Supreme Court decided was, under the intermediate scrutiny standard, it was perfectly okay for this to be true. If that child's parent, the U.S. citizen, had been a mom, the child would not have been deported. But because the child's parent was a dad, the child could be deported and, in fact, was deported simply because the father hadn't jumped through a hoop when the child was very young when they moved back to the U.S. to actually officially promise on the record to love and support and care for his child. In other words, we assume that mothers are going to do that, but we don't assume that fathers are going to do that. I would argue from that case that the intermediate scrutiny standard is too weak, that equal protection isn't really equal for men and for women. It's also been argued by a lot of scholars that the standard is simply too fuzzy or inconsistent, and you can see that if you look at federal equal protection law, contrasting a case like Nguyen, which really doesn't guarantee equality. In fact, it really reinforces gender stereotypes, with a case like VMI, which was the case that in which the Supreme Court said it was not okay for a military academy to refuse to admit females as students. The basic reasoning behind that was any such exclusion of women would be based on gender stereotypes. There was no good basis for it otherwise, and therefore the ban on women students was overturned. So some people look at VMI and say, well, that's not really intermediate scrutiny. That's strict scrutiny in disguise. It's basically hard to know that the standards are messy. I think the bottom line is that it's simply better to treat sex discrimination like race discrimination. Both types of discrimination are serious problems, and both deserve strict scrutiny. One quick example of how this can matter, in Texas, where they do have an ERA, there was a case that was very much like the federal Nguyen case that had to do with dad's rights. And in that case, they decided essentially exactly the opposite of what the federal court decided. In that case, they said dads don't have to jump through any extra hoops to prove that they deserve to be a parent. So if we have in Minnesota a state amendment that establishes gender equality or sex equality, we'll get that strict scrutiny standard. And I think that's consistent with what our citizens want. There's been polling, at least in the last decade or so, about what people think about equal rights and an equal rights amendment. And it shows that they, first of all, you know, thank goodness in this day and age, agree that men and women are equal and should be treated equally under the law. They also think that our laws should express that. They should say explicitly that men and women need to be treated equally. The problem is people think that it's already there, and it's not. Maybe some of that confusion relates to this whole complexity of how we understand what equal protection really means. But I think a sophisticated understanding of the law, and you look at cases like Nguyen, and you think, we're not there yet. We really do need to express this in our state constitution. And I think, as other people have pointed out, you know, many other things are captured in the state constitution, the right to hunt and fish and to gamble. If we can spend the time and energy to put those sorts of issues into the state constitution, we certainly can place into the constitution such a bedrock principle of justice that men and women should be treated equally. So reason number two, going back to my three reasons, we still need to guarantee equality because inequality still persists in our culture, in our community. And you're going to hear a bunch of testimony today on all sorts of topics like equal opportunity, pay equity, workforce flexibility, gender fairness in the court systems, a reduction of gender violence and domestic abuse. If we want to deal with those issues, we really have to focus on the issue of equality. And admittedly, passing this equal rights amendment is not going to magically eliminate any of those problems, but it does provide us with a necessary tool. At its core, I think this is a question of basic justice. Should men and women have equal rights under the law? Our answer to this question should be enshrined in the state constitution so that it can inform every single decision that our legislature and courts make. And I think to think about this in a more concrete legal way, we really need this both backwards and forwards. In the backward sense, we need this because we have made a lot of progress. We've made tremendous progress in the recent decades. But that progress can be rolled back, and we saw an example of this recently at the federal level. People were pretty shocked by a case called Ledbetter. I think everyone in this room is probably familiar with that case. In that case, the federal Supreme Court found that women have no right to sue an employer for gender discrimination in terms of their pay that's gone on for decades, merely because that gender discrimination had gone on for decades. In other words, the court basically said, it's too late for you to sue, even though each new paycheck that you get pays you less than the male employees, simply because they're men and you're women. Congress fixed that poor decision by passing the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, but that might not have been necessary if we had enshrined in our law to begin with the idea that men and women need to be treated equally under the law. Looking forward, I think the best way to understand why we need an ERA is to recognize that questions will continually arise. There will be new questions. And I could give you lots of examples from the other states that actually have a state ERA of where the state ERA has made a difference as new questions have arisen. But in the interest of time, I just want to mention one, specifically jury selection. Do men and women have an equal right to serve on juries? Hopefully we would all say, yes, they do. This is a core political right, both for the people who are accused and for those of us who would want to serve as citizen jurors. But the federal equal protection standard, under a case called Batson, doesn't fully protect that right. By contrast, we can look at a state like Illinois, which has a state ERA and has strict scrutiny under that state ERA. And in that state, you find that the right to serve on a jury is better protected, both for men and for women. We could also cite other new questions, such as those raised by new forms of medically assisted reproduction, because those raise all sorts of questions about what does it really mean to be a mom? What does it really mean to be a dad? All of those are gender equality issues. I think the bottom line is that we may not yet agree on the right answer to all sorts of questions, either existing questions or questions we haven't even thought of yet. Certainly, we may not all agree on how we should think about issues like abortion or same-sex marriage. But I do think we can at least agree that however we answer those tough questions, our answer should be consistent with gender equality. Gender equality should be a bedrock principle of Minnesota law. So finally, I want to touch briefly on reason number three. Passing an equal rights amendment will reflect and reinforce Minnesota's leading role in the modern global economy. I think you'll recognize today that the testimony here underscores that gender equality is an economic issue, and it's an issue we face not just in Minnesota, but everywhere. The roots of this persistent inequality lie in our attitudes about men and women, who men and women are, and what they're capable of doing. Because of this, I think it's really important for all of us to take part in a conversation about what equality really means. The legislature and the courts need this amendment for some of the reasons I've already discussed, but I think ordinary citizens need it too. We need to wrestle with these issues expressly in order to solve them effectively. And I'd like to point out, maybe in part because of my own, I have an academic background in an area called cognitive science, and so also something called cognitive bias. I'd like you to note especially the testimony you'll hear today about recent social science research into that area. What we're finding, what the scientists are finding, is that the brain works in mysterious ways, which we're only just beginning to understand. What that means is we're not done discussing gender equality. We can't let the gender equality conversation end with that 1970s or 1980s stalemate and a 1970s or 1980s level knowledge. Finally, I just want to point out exactly why passing an amendment now will demonstrate Minnesota's leadership. Like I said, we need to talk about our new understanding, the scientifically enhanced understanding of the causes of persistent discrimination. In doing so, we're going to educate the public of this state, and we're going to stand as a role model for other states, most of which also still lack a state ERA. We can also take a leading role at the national level because there's a debate going on at the national level about a revived federal equal rights amendment, And finally, we can earn the right, really earn the right, to participate in the global conversation. I think people are probably familiar with the acronym CEDAW. That's the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. If we kind of put this in layers, we have a state ERA, the federal ERA, and CEDAW is the cap to all that because it's the global level ERA, if I can oversimplify it. 185 countries have ratified CEDAW, and the United States, is not one of them. Unfortunately, what that means is it diminishes our leadership globally on questions of human rights and gender equality. So efforts on each one of these three levels, the state level, the national level, and the global level, they matter, and they reinforce each other. So I'd like us to take this opportunity to be on the forefront of all three levels. Thank you again, Chairman Mo, and your staff and the members of this committee for considering this important bill.
Thank you. Any questions for the professor? We're good. Ms. Brennigan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members, my name is Amy Brennigan. I'm the Director of the Office on the Economic Status of Women here at the Legislature. And my role today was to give a little bit of an overview of the economic status of women in Minnesota and provide a bridge between the legal testimony you just received and some of the more issue-specific information that will come after me. And hopefully I will add to some of the understanding about why we need this amendment, and haven't we already solved equality? Certainly, there's no doubt that women have made significant progress over time and that we have overcome some significant hurdles in the very recent past. It was only in 1993 that FMLA became law, and it was only in 2008 that General Ann Dunwoody became the first woman to serve as a four-star general in the United States. And it was just a year ago, in 2009, that this body made it illegal for insurance providers in our state to deny coverage to a woman because having a cesarean section was considered a pre-existing condition. There is still much progress to be made. Let me point out a few statistics and some information. In Minnesota, women still earn just 79 cents to the dollar compared to men, despite our leading efforts on pay equity and comparable worth for state employees and public employees. You'll hear more about pay equity and wage gap from the two ladies sitting next to me. Back in the 50s, women who wanted to work had primarily three choices: teachers, nurses, and secretaries. Deed information provided to me says that in 2008, for women who were full-time wage and salary workers, the 10 most prevalent occupations were secretaries and administrative assistants, registered nurses, elementary and middle school teachers, receptionists, supervisors of receptionists, accountants, bookkeepers, customer service representatives, child care workers, and supervisors of administrative workers. One of the poorest segments of the economy is single women with children. A single female-headed household in our state with only children under the age of 5 is 12 times more likely to be living in poverty than the equivalent married couple household. In 2007, domestic violence programs across the state served 25,000 adults and 10,000 children. These programs also administer hotel, motel, and safe home programs, which house an additional 470 adults and 542 children. Most of these adults were women. Most of the survivors of domestic violence are women, and many of them are Native American women in our state. Right now, the median income for older women in Minnesota is $12,691. That's half of the median income for men in the same age group category, 65 and over, $25,000. American Indian women aged 65 years and over have had one of the highest proportions of women in poverty in history. We're fourth in the nation for the percentage of women in government, yet that still is just 34.8% for state office, and in local offices it sags even more, as low as 11% for female county commissioners, many of whom are the only woman on their commission. In the boardroom, the percentages are not much higher. Women account for 14% of the available board seats in Minnesota's 100 largest publicly held companies. One area of hope in our sagging economy has been the entrance of green jobs, green enterprises. Yet, where are women in these efforts? Last week, the American Association of University Women released a new report on women in science and engineering careers. Science and engineering careers and non-traditional trades-related occupations often make up the bulk of green careers. In the report, they said, the lack of women and girls pursuing such subjects has significant implications for women's economic security, as well as the overall economy and America's global competitiveness. If women and members of other traditionally underrepresented groups joined the workforce in these professions, in the proportion to their representation in the overall labor force, the shortage of professionals in these fields would disappear. The U.S. is the only industrialized nation with no paid family leave of any kind. We do guarantee time but not pay. This puts us in the company of three other countries, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. So you can see there are multiple causes for inequity. These aren't new issues. Though there has been progress, they're not over. And just as the causes are not simple and singular, neither are the solutions. True equity will not be the result of just one of these problems being solved. All of them must be addressed in order to achieve parity. So you'll hear today a few of us talking about tools in the toolbox. A state constitutional amendment for equality may not be the answer, but it is certainly a tool to move us forward. I also like to say there's no silver bullet. My work shows me that gender equality, economically and socially, will only be achieved with multifaceted, sustained, hard work. This has to go hand in hand with a variety of policy efforts like this, ones that are important both in their own right and as part of a larger, comprehensive effort. I'll end where I began. Despite some of these sobering statistics, I do remember that women have progressed. And I believe that it is true that sometimes women are often underestimated. I look at the international model of the Grameen Bank. Many of you know this model. Muhammad Yunus started this in Bangladesh in 1976. He began the bank by loaning a small group of poor women $27 so that they could create small items for sale without the burdens of predatory lending. Grameen Bank now serves 6 million borrowers, 96% of whom are women. I look to our state and to our matched savings program, the FAME program. Low-income workers can enter this program and save for 3 years for one of three assets, owning a home, owning a business, or achieving higher education. In that program, over 75% of the enrollees are women. And I also don't underestimate the buying power of women in Minnesota and beyond. Every 60 seconds, a woman opens a new business. Women write 80% of all checks in the U.S. Women initiate 4 out of 5 home improvement projects. And we make 88% of all retail purchases. Full equity, then, will not only benefit women, it will benefit all of us. I reiterate, today's conversation is not an end, it's a beginning. A constitutional amendment for equality will not solve all of the problems or challenges for women that exist economically, socially, and the like, but it certainly will help solidify some of the progress we've made and bring us a step closer to true parity. I think for me personally also, this conversation is critical, just that you're willing to sit and listen and have the conversation with all of us here today brings us one step closer to true equality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brennigan. Any questions? All right. Ms. Angie or Ms. Fitzpatrick, please just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Patty Tangi. I'm the president of Pay Equity Coalition. I'm also president of Minnesota Businesswomen.
Could you move your mic closer?
Oh, absolutely. Chair Mua and members of the Judiciary Committee, I'd like to mention to you that I find this a very high honor and privilege to be here with you today, and I thank you all for your commitment to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. The Pay Equity Coalition was formed in the early 1980s to help educate the public about the notion of comparable worth or equal pay for jobs of equal worth, and to help get our two pay equity laws passed in this state. The coalition consists of about 60 individuals and women's groups and unions that are all passionate about the issue of fair pay. The coalition's role today is to monitor current laws and any attempts to weaken the statute and to advise state and local governments around the country on what we're doing here in Minnesota and to help others like us, implement these similar laws in their states and local governments. The Minnesota pay equity laws are held as models for pay equity around the country. Other states have followed suit to some degree or another. As a result of the success of the laws that have virtually the gender gap has virtually been eliminated for state employees here in the state of Minnesota, for that we thank our legislators. In 1982, the state passed the State Government Pay Equity Act, and in 1984, the Local Government Pay Equity Act, and they're a little bit different. The legislation was designed to eliminate sex-based wage disparities in public employment in this state, and more specifically, to establish equitable compensation relationships, which means the compensation for female-dominated job classes is not consistently below the compensation for male-dominated job classes of comparable work value. These laws have eliminated the gender-based wage gap between full-time year-round workers in state government and according to the Minnesota Management and Budget. But because we don't collect the same data for local governments, we do not know the effect of these laws in local governments. Each local government is examined separately. Wages from one local government are not compared to wages of another. And so we don't know the median wage for all men and women working for local governments. But we do know that after job and pay analysis is done every 3 years for each local government, even after 26 years that the law has been in place, the pay practices continue to show patterns of paying women less for jobs that they themselves, the local governments, have determined are of similar value. According to the January 2010 report from Minnesota Management and Budget, some of the female-dominated jobs that received pay increases as a result of the pay analysis by our work here are accounting clerk, administrative assistant, city clerk, treasurer, executive assistant, secretary, and utility billing clerk. These jobs all fall within the same categories that Amy mentioned earlier as prevalent female occupations. Bias in wage setting is still very much practiced throughout the country in the public and private sector. A study released as early as December 2009 by some researchers at Stanford University and the University of Pennsylvania. They looked at occupations over 50 years from 1950 to 2000 and concluded that a 10% increase in the proportion of females in an occupation associates with a 5% decrease in an hourly wage for each decade. The study was controlled by education and skill. So we at the Pay Equity Coalition understand that today, even in the state of Minnesota, we have a wage gap of 21 cents, but we are making progress. We believe that an amendment for equality will help create a foundation for putting to rest some of the underlying assumptions about pay and the undervaluing work that women perform. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Hange? Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you. I have a handout for the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I'm the director of the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute, the University of Minnesota. The Wage Project estimates that over the course of her lifetime, a woman will earn $1 million less than a man simply because she is a woman. For women who graduate from professional schools, that number can climb to $2 million. Today, I would like to share some data related to the prevalence of the pay gap right here in Minnesota. Progress has been slow since Congress recognized the concept of equal pay for equal work in the 1963 Equal Pay Act. The gap in Minnesota and nationally actually grew slightly from 2007 to 2008, from the 21 cents that both Amy and Patty mentioned to 76 cents on a man's dollar in 2008. In Minnesota, the gap exists in every occupation, including those dominated by women. For example, as the first table in your handout shows, in education, the gap is 22 cents on the dollar, 12 cents in community and social service fields, and 11 cents in the healthcare support sector. The largest gaps are found in transportation and material moving at 49 cents, legal occupations at 47 cents, sales at 34 cents, and healthcare practitioners at 38 cents. The wage gap grows over a woman's life. In Minnesota, it starts out at 5% among 19 to 24-year-olds and grows to 26% among 51 to 64-year-olds. In their negotiation trainings for young women, the Wage Project shows how small differences in salary right out of college compound over time, as bonuses and raises are based on a person's base salary. Several studies show that women are less likely than men to negotiate for salaries and other benefits, but even when they do negotiate, they are more often penalized. Assertiveness is often perceived as desirable in men, but not in women. Studies in several sectors also show that gender stereotypes result in lower promotion levels for women, which also leads to greater disparities over time. The gap is in place across education levels. Although it is smaller for Minnesota women with doctorate degrees, it is the largest for women with professional degrees. The gap is present across the state from a high of 30 cents on the dollar to a low of 16 cents on the dollar. Generally, rural areas of the state have a higher gap than the Twin Cities, but it's prevalent everywhere. Some call it the mom bomb and others the maternal wall, but whatever you call it, the evidence is mounting that the wage gap is not just about being a woman. Being a mother carries a much heavier wage penalty than being a father. A study conducted by Harvard School of Business in 2004 found that when women give birth, their colleagues view them as kinder, gentler, and less capable. For men who become fathers, warmth ratings also increase, but their competence levels remain unchanged. A national study conducted by the GAO found that being a parent held women back. After having children, income levels of fathers increased and income levels of mothers decreased. Our analysis of American Community Survey data shown in your handout for Minnesota show that earnings for mothers that continue to work full-time year-round remain about equal whether or not there are children. But fathers earn more than men without children, and the earnings gap increases along with the number of children in the home. Now, there are many factors that affect wages, including demographics such as race and parental status, and work-related factors such as occupation, employer, and hours worked. When the Federal Government Accounting Office controlled for these factors and others, such as type of position, job tenure, and workforce absences, they concluded, even after accounting for key factors that affect earnings, our model could not explain all of the difference in earnings between men and women. Some studies place the percentage of unexplainable difference as high as 40%. For researchers and groups as diverse as the GAO and the National Committee on Pay Equity, the remaining gap is at least in part attributable to some form of discrimination, including sexism. Discrimination based on stereotypes is an important aspect of wage inequity. A growing body of research that Jill alluded to earlier documents the presence of implicit or unconscious bias based on gender, race, and other issues. I already mentioned research on parenthood. Stereotypical ideas about leadership and gender also have an important impact on women's wages and their chances for promotion. Several studies have looked at how men and women job or promotion seekers are assessed by assigning male and female names to the same resume or adding elements to the resume that suggest motherhood or fatherhood. Researchers have shown that men are rated more highly for the same resume and that women in general, but especially those that present as mothers, are penalized with lower ratings for the exact same experiences and background. The breadwinner stereotype is also alive and well, both unconsciously and overtly. Plaintiffs still report that they are told they don't make as much as men because the men have families to support. Our research shows that 4 in 10 Minnesota women are now the primary, I should say 4 in 10 Minnesota mothers are now the primary breadwinner in their family. A majority in some communities of color hold this status. However, this stereotype persists and still results in lower pay in some circumstances. So given the pervasive and tenacious nature of wage inequities in Minnesota, we need every tool possible, as Amy mentioned. A constitutional amendment makes an important statement about the state's ongoing commitment to equality for men and women and adds one more important tool for those who are working to make this ideal a reality. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Ms. Fitzpatrick, I'm intrigued by the womb wall research that you did. I know that in the legal profession, and I think in the law firm setting, at least my cohort of women lawyers were concerned that because the partnership ladder is sometimes dependent on the length of time you've put into the firm. Right. And so in some ways, the womb disadvantage is that oftentimes on the same trajectory as a male colleague, that if I have to take, you know, 3 to 6 months off for maternity leave before I come back, that somehow I'm 6 months behind my colleague in the same trajectory. And while we can't unhook the womb and transfer it to our male colleagues, although it'd be an interesting research project, how have other nations dealt with this? Is it because, you know, men are giving comparable womb leaves so that we're all in the same kind of time slot? I mean, I'm curious about how this plays out in other countries, or, you know, what would be a practical public policy solution to that other than taking off the womb?
Well, I'm not an expert on what other countries have done on this issue, but I guess in general I would say, I'd just go back to your point about other countries, some other countries anyway, situations that allow women to continue their jobs and not take as much time out of the workforce, because the workforce situation is more flexible, has paid leave opportunities for both men and women, and those kinds of issues. I would just say that, again, the GAO and others have tried to control for those issues about how the issues of motherhood might be affected or how time out of the workforce affects the wage earnings, and have found that even when they control for those issues, you still have the gap. So,
thank you. Is it Mr. Derry and Mr. Barnes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Derry. I am the co-founder of the Gender Violence Institute located in Clearwater, Minnesota, and a co-coordinator of the Minnesota Men's Action Network Alliance to Prevent Sexual and Domestic Violence. I also serve as a co-convener of the Minnesota Department of Health's Policy and Legislative Action Team to support the implementation of the department's 5-year sexual violence prevention plan. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. The Federal Violence Against Women's Act of 2005 states that nearly one-third of American women report physical and sexual abuse by a husband or boyfriend at some point in their lives. The Minnesota Department of Health estimates that 61,000 Minnesotans are victims of sexual violence per year, and the economic cost of the state in 2005 was roughly $8 billion. In 2006, according to records from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, roughly 48,500 Minnesota women and children sought community advocacy and/or emergency shelter services due to domestic abuse. This is estimated to represent only 21% of domestic violence cases per year in Minnesota. Accordingly, according to the Department of Health, this violence has become endemic. That is, this level of sexual and domestic violence has become a social norm. In fact, it is clear that this many men could not be assaulting this many women without widespread cultural support. Utilizing a public health primary prevention model that focuses on changing the environment in which injury or violence occurs, we can confront the normalization of sexual and domestic violence. We do this by changing those messages, images, institutional practices, and public policies which support dominant, sexually violent, and degrading behaviors. To stop this violence before it starts, we begin to examine the socialization of boys and men. How is it possible that this many boys in Minnesota are growing into men who abuse women? Women they know and are in relationship with. We know that a common motive for both sexual and domestic violence perpetrators is to overpower and control women. The violence is used to subjugate the female victim over time. We also know from working with offenders that they rely heavily on social constructs of gender inequality to bolster their justifications for their violence. It is their right and privilege to control women. This notion of male authority and the inferior status of women manifests itself as male victims of male crime, as female victims of male crime search for help. They're often asked what they did to deserve it, how she upset him, what clothes was she wearing, was she drunk. These questions often translate into the belief that if he is assaulting her, he must have deserved it in some way. She must have deserved it in some way. This removes any critical investigation of his behavior, supports his use of violence to control her, and further isolates and traumatizes female victims. The social and economic status of men allows us to control not just individual women, but women in general. All women must change their behaviors to account for the threat or reality of male violence. All women experience economic disparities in salaries and advancement based solely on gender. This keeps women physically dependent on men and subsequently socially vulnerable to men's violence and control. At the core of this behavior is the belief that men have more value than women. The Minnesota Constitutional Amendment for Equality will institutionalize gender equality. It will challenge the beliefs of those men who would abuse women or treat them like social subordinates, that women are, in fact, a vital part of our community, that women's constitutionally guaranteed right to equal status in the law is critical for a healthy and sustainable society. The Minnesota Constitutional Amendment for Equality would provide another example of how far we have come in the last 30 years in creating our vision of a world free from sexual and domestic violence. This is a fundamental step in making the commitment to women's rights, freedom, and liberty a reality in our communities. I can't imagine why my daughter, sister, or wife does not deserve the same respect and opportunity as my son or brother or myself. This amendment would ensure that principle and in this way become a cornerstone in the foundation of our efforts to build safe, healthy environments where every individual can live to their full potential, in this case, free from the threat or reality of sexual and domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Barnes.
Hi there. My name's Graham Barnes. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I've lived here since 2003. I work with the Battered Women's Justice Project and with the Duluth Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. That project is an international model for building partnership between community and government agencies that respond to violence against women. So in many ways, I live in Minnesota because in so many ways, Minnesota has led the world in responding to domestic violence, and that's what has brought me here from New Zealand. I see similar social problems of the inequity between men and women in the United States and New Zealand and Australia, where I've done similar work. And when I look at who's doing damage to who, it's pretty much the same. About 85% of the domestic violence we're seeing in New Zealand is perpetrated by men against women. And so 15% of the violence is not perpetrated by men against women, but and we need to respond equitably to all kinds of domestic violence. But the fact that it's 85% a male responsibility, I think, is a big opportunity there for men to take a strong stand towards equality and look at the way our institutions intervene. So I'm here mostly today to talk about how our court systems and our government agencies are intervening with domestic violence cases, and they're ill-equipped to do it. They need a lot of reform because most of those institutions were not created to deal with private violence. And so when the institutions intervene, they have an inadequate response to victims. And so in my work through the Battered Women's Justice Project, we provide technical assistance to communities around the United States, drawing on the Duluth model, which is saying that the people with the least power need the most advocacy. And it's my experience that that we've got a long way to go to change the institutions so that they provide some equality and justice. There's no doubt in my mind that the courts currently favour men, and yet if you listen to fathers' rights groups, they would tell you the opposite. I think they're wrong, and I think the evidence is there to see that we need to adjust all of our institutions so that there's a level playing field. Many people think we already have the level playing field, but our experience through working with the Office on Violence Against Women is that we really need to adjust the way our institutions intervene as far as domestic violence. That's just one small piece of the picture. That's the part that I work in, and I see it so clearly. that we've got a long way to go before that system is just. And the difficulty with arguing for this, and I think it's a misrepresentation, is that because many people feel like the or believe that the playing field is level, that such a focus on women's rights and women's issues to some people seems unreasonable. And yet my experience is that we don't have equality in terms of how our institutions intervene on domestic violence. And my experience is similar with sexual assault. And the difficulty with this when we talk about this is that I think in trying to address a power imbalance, in trying to bring women to equality with men, a lot of the men who we work with assume we're saying that women should be the boss of men. And to me, sitting here as a feminist male, I believe in feminism. I think feminism is not about women bossing men around. It's about women having the same access to justice as men. And so we're looking for equal access to justice for women, and that directly benefits men. And the reason it benefits men is because it makes it possible for men to have equal relationships with women. And inequality, that's where trust and love can grow. It can't grow when there's an inequity. And so I think we need to be mindful that with this kind of agenda for the ERA, that there will be a backlash against it from men's rights groups, and I think that's predictable. And I think it's always predictable that groups that have enjoyed privilege and power for long periods of time historically will object to it being challenged. And so we're not sitting here arguing that women should be the boss of men. We're arguing for equality between men and women. And we're seeing that need through working with changes in the institutions that intervene on those cases. So I think we need to be mindful that the backlash to this is misinformed and it misrepresents the goals of what we're trying to achieve. And so for anyone in the legislature who would take a stand on this leaves them vulnerable to being accused of being anti-male, and I think that's a misrepresentation. I certainly don't sit here saying that women should be the boss of men, but I do know through the experience of my work of more than 20 years that the institutions are not the playing field is not level, the institutions are not fair, and we need to adjust that. And that's in the interests of men as much as it is in the interests of women, and particularly for children to grow up with that.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these two witnesses? Thank you. Let's see. Ms. Anderson, and then Ms. Aviva Breen is also here. Please, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Marna Anderson, and I am the executive director of WATCH. We are a volunteer-based court monitoring and research organization operating in Hennepin County, and we've been monitoring Hennepin County Court since 1993. Our mission is to make the justice system more effective and responsive on cases of violence, particularly against women and children, and to create a more informed and involved public. In addition to operating in Minnesota, we had, like many great ideas that have started in Minnesota, we export our model to other states, and so we are a model in that way as well. I'm going to just take a few minutes to talk a little bit about our monitor's observations, because even though I believe gender discrimination is less blatant now than it was when we started monitoring 16 years ago, we still observe evidence of gender discrimination in the courts. I would say, and most of it's related to underlying cultural beliefs. So, for example, beliefs that women make up stories of abuse or rape to get a leg up on a divorce, to get back at their boyfriend or husband, or to have for financial gain. So even though national statistics indicate that false accusations of domestic violence and rape are as rare as they are as other types of crime, about 2%, women often find themselves face to face with this belief when they confront the justice system. And that comes out mostly in comments made by attorneys and judges and also jurors' decisions. And I'm just going to read three examples for you that our monitors have gathered over the last couple of years. A judge suggests to a petitioner in an order for protection proceeding that a divorce could lead to her financial ruin, and he quips, "You may end up joining the circus and living in a tent." It's not exactly what you want to hear when you're going for legal protection from your abuser. A jury acquits a defendant accused of second-degree assault for strangling his girlfriend until she passed out. The prosecution had medical evidence, eyewitnesses, a 911 tape, and a defendant's admission to the victim's teen daughter at the scene. But this was not enough for the jury, who said to the prosecutor after the case ended that they believed the victim, quote, exaggerated the assault because she saw her meal ticket walking out the door. A judge denies an order for protection, a request for an order for protection, stating that he believed the relationship was, quote, full of jealousy and animosity, and that the drama was being played out in a domestic violence court proceeding. This petition also described a strangulation assault that was being heard in the criminal courts. Perhaps one of the most obvious examples of gender discrimination in the courts is in the child protection cases, where Watch recently completed an 18-month-long monitoring project. Females were the subjects of 93% of the child protection petitions in the cases we monitored in Hennepin County, 93%. This is partly because women are more frequently the custodial parents, the primary caregivers, but partly because of increased scrutiny of women who seek public services such as subsidized housing and economic assistance. Approximately 85% of the reports that are made to child protection are made by mandated reporters, doctors, teachers, and social workers. In short, women are more frequently the subjects of child protection investigations because they face greater economic disadvantages than men do. And in child protection proceedings involving domestic violence, which tends to be, research shows, about 30 to 50% of the child protection cases, there is also the mother is also being battered. Frequently, the assaults do not result in charges or arrests against the violent abuser. Instead, the children are temporarily removed from their mother's care until she can prove to the courts that she is capable of protecting her children from the abuser. So the criminal case goes away, the abuser is not held accountable, and the mother is left to pick up the pieces and try to jump through all of the case plan work that the courts is asking her to do so she can eventually get her children back. In one of the cases Watch monitored, the mother, who suffered from depression and addiction, was only allowed supervised visits with her children. In contrast, the father of one of her children, who is a convicted sex offender, was allowed unsupervised visits. The reason she was not allowed unsupervised visits is because she was not attending her support groups at one of the advocacy organizations. But I do want to leave you with some good news, and it's this. We also gather a lot of evidence in the courts that I believe supports the notion that changing the laws changes attitudes. And there's examples of ways in which the justice system, because it does act swiftly and appropriately in many of these types of cases, it changes attitudes of family members of victims, and we've seen that in the courts. So I want to read one example to you. During a sentencing, the victim stated that her relationship with the defendant had grown stronger, and she believed the violence wouldn't happen again. Afterward, the judge addressed the defendant, saying, "However forgiving your girlfriend will be if this happens again, the court system will not. A man abusing a woman will simply not be tolerated, and the court takes domestic abuse very seriously." A constitutional amendment for equality provides an opportunity to keep moving down this path where the justice system is sometimes, and in some ways, ahead of societal beliefs. And I think you have the opportunity, we have the opportunity, to explicitly make equality a firm principle of law and solidify women's equality and hope and eventually create a less biased justice system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? Very good. Ms. Breen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aviva Breen, and I was asked to speak here today as a member of the task force, Supreme Court Task Force for Gender Fairness in the Courts. Perhaps I should have gone before Ms. Anderson. Just a little history lesson, and I'll start with an anecdote. The very first time I ever came to this Capitol to talk to lawmakers was in the middle 70s to lobby for the ERA. So,
and you're still here.
Yes, here I am again, so I feel like I'm 35 years younger. The task force was established in 1987 and completed its work in 1989. And the mandate of the task force really was to explore the extent to which gender bias exists in the Minnesota state court system by ascertaining whether statutes, rules, practices, or conduct work unfairness or undue hardship on women or men in our courts. Document where found the existence of discriminatory treatment of women or men, litigants, witnesses, jurors, and of women, judicial, legal, and court personnel. Recommend methods to eliminate gender bias in the courts, including the development and provisions of necessary judicial education, the passage of legislation, and the promulgation of court rules and policy revisions. Report the findings and then monitor the implementation of the approved reform measures and evaluate their effectiveness in assuring gender fairness in the courts. And I will say that this report was submitted in 1989, and the very forward-thinking then Chief Justice Amdahl immediately appointed an implementation committee. I did serve on that committee for 20 years, and then I decided it was enough, so I did go off last year. But the work is still being done and is continuing, and there are reports, and obviously progress is being made, and some progress isn't being made, and it's an ongoing process. There was a lot that was very interesting that was learned, and I won't go on about all of it, but one aspect that really speaks to the ongoing problems is that there was a huge difference in the response of female and male attorneys, female and male judges, to some of the questions that the task force surveyed, and in their perception of whether gender bias in the courts existed. For example, half of the male attorneys, but only 9% of the female attorneys, said that they had never seen gender bias exhibited in the courtroom. And similarly, in response to a question about attorneys' perceptions of gender bias against women, at that time, 48% of the female attorneys, but only 10% of the male attorneys, said that gender bias in the court was widespread but subtle and hard to detect. So the perceptions varied according, apparently and obviously, to which side individuals were on. And there is ongoing work that's been done and progress in a lot of areas, but the areas of perception, and particularly in this context of those who are intimately involved with the court system, have to change over time, but of course new people come in. And the advantage of having a constitutional bar that is high enough to indicate that this is an important distinction that the courts and that individuals in society and any public entity represents gives notice that the standard will be higher, and that inability to operate within a system that isn't discriminatory will result in an action, and that the decision to do something that is discriminatory, regardless of what one's perceptions are, will be looked at in a much more serious manner. So that was what the task force was trying to look at and has been trying to continue to review over the years. Much of that bias has changed because of the participation and because of the perception and because of the continuous review. But creating a constitutional standard that will exist, I think, just simply sets that bar high enough that more attention will be paid for it and adds to the ability to overcome those perceptions and biases, which have real results for real people.
Thank you. Thank you. Any witnesses for these two? Any questions for these two witnesses? No. Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Ms. Breen. You were referring, or you made comments or made reading from a manual of sorts. Could you tell me what that is?
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, this is the report.
Oh,
this
yes.
is the
okay.
actual report of the Task Force on Gender Fairness, which I spoke about a lot, which is why I have all the Post-its in it. But
sure.
And actually, the Implementation Committee has issued updates. I didn't bring it all with me, but they are available. And it's not been regular over the last 20 years, but I'd say about every 5 years, the implementation committee has reviewed what it set out to do in that five-year period and what's happened and what they're working on continually. But this is it. This is the actual report.
Okay, Madam Chair,
Senator,
could you give us the title of the task force?
It's
so that if I wanted to read on that material, I would have a resource.
It is the Minnesota Supreme Court Task Force for Gender Fairness in the Courts, and that title was suggested by Justice Wall, who didn't want to talk about gender bias but wanted to look for gender fairness.
Okay, and what year?
1989. The report was issued September 1989.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Limmer and members, I think that if there's an interest, I had intended to do this year yet, or we may if we when we all come back next session, I would be interested in having a discussion on this report. It's my understanding that this year is an anniversary year and that there has been some work done to review the original report and do sort of a status check on where we are with respect to that report. You will see that once this conversation is over, we're going to have a conversation about Senator Latz's bill and the racial impact screening of legislation. But at the same time period where we looked at the bias in the courts on gender, there was also a similar commission to look at bias in the courts with respect to race and ethnicity. And I think that it would be, given the interest of this committee, it would be good to have perhaps a briefing on those two initial reports and then an update on kind of where we're at from the people who are doing the work. And so it's my intention to do that at some point. If not this session yet, perhaps at the beginning of the next legislative session. I think it would be informative. And you know, just in light of Mr. Barnes's testimony, I would be interested in you know, inviting him back to maybe give us a little bit of perspective on perhaps some more detail information on where he think systems changes could be made to maybe level that playing field a little bit. I found his testimony to be very intriguing. Thank you both. We have two other testifiers on this subject, Ms. Jordan Marie Bauer and Mr. Tom Pritchard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jordan Marie Bauer, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization with more than 70,000 member families and over 240 chapters across the state. Thank you again for allowing me to speak here today, and I would just like to share some of the concerns of the pro-life community regarding the proposed ERA. For decades, many prominent pro-choice organizations have argued that a proper legal interpretation of the language contained in the ERA is to invalidate laws that treat abortion differently from other medical procedures, including laws restricting taxpayer funding of abortion and laws requiring parental notification or consent for minors' abortions. Essentially, the legal argument is this: only females seek abortion, so any government policy that restricts access to abortion or treats abortion differently from procedures performed on men, on its face is an abridgment of rights on account of sex, which is exactly what the ERA forbids. A 1998 ruling by the New Mexico Supreme Court provides a clear demonstration of the very real power of this legal argument. The New Mexico ERA adopted to its state constitution says, quote, "Equality under law shall not be denied on account of the sex of any person," end quote, which is very similar to today's proposal. The New Mexico Supreme Court agreed that the state's refusal to fund elective abortions violated the state ERA. The court ordered the state to pay for all so-called medically necessary abortions, which, as applied, means any abortion performed by a licensed medical professional, if procedures sought by men are also funded. Thus, the order essentially requires the state to pay for abortion on demand for Medicaid-eligible women. The ruling was based solely on the state ERA, and in writing for the court, Justice Pamela Minsner wrote that denying funding for abortions, quote, "undoubtedly singles out for less than favorable treatment a gender-linked condition that is unique to women," end quote. This same analysis that limits on abortion are by definition a form of sex discrimination and therefore impermissible under the ERA could be used to invalidate restrictions on late-term abortions or parental notification and consent laws. The New Mexico ruling validates years of warnings by MCCL and our national affiliate, the National Right to Life Committee, that ERAs can be used as powerful pro-choice legal tools unless they are suitably amended. The lawsuit urging the New Mexico court to adopt the doctrine that the ERA-mandated state-funded abortion was filed by the state affiliates of NARAL and Planned Parenthood, and briefs supporting the successful argument were filed by major national groups such as the ACLU, the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, and the Now Legal Defense and Education Fund. MCCL has recognized the likelihood of judicial interpretations, such as the New Mexico ruling, and has insisted on the need for adopting an abortion neutralization amendment to any ERA. The amendment would add to the ERA the sentence, quote, "Nothing in this article shall be construed to grant, secure, or deny any right relating to abortion or the funding thereof," end quote. MCCL and Minnesota's pro-life community thank you for your consideration of this fix to make the ERA abortion neutral and would oppose any unamended ERA. Thank you, and I would be happy to take any of your questions.
Any questions for the witness? Very good. Mr. Pritchard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'd like to speak in opposition to the bill. I guess the first question I'd ask is the amendment necessary? And I would argue no. Will it benefit women by eliminating invidious discrimination against women in employment, education, opportunity, housing, public accommodations? We would argue no. Currently, there exist remedies for addressing these concerns. What will be the effect, the primary effect? We believe it will empower the courts to engage in all sorts of social mischief and social engineering. And secondly, it will actually result in some rights or potential rights being taken away from women. First, it would give enormous power to the courts in general. The courts would be the ones defining what the word sex and equality actually mean. And I find it interesting that this bill is being pushed at the same time a constitutional amendment is being pushed to eliminate judicial candidate elections, which in our view would also solidify a lack of accountability for the courts. And we believe that this will mean, this equal rights amendment will mean more mandates on the people of Minnesota emanating from the courts. We believe it will also open the door to the courts legislating on domestic issues like marriage. The ERA could be used to force schools and colleges to no longer be single sex. It could force sexual integration of fraternities, sororities, youth organizations, and other single sex organizations. We think it could be argued that this could be used to target the tax-exempt status of churches, mosques, and synagogues, which recognize differences between males and females. It would give judges the basis for arguing for abortion rights, as already was argued, and mandate abortion funding. It could also be used, as I mentioned previously, to mandate homosexual marriage. Courts in four states have ruled that the ERA provisions in those state constitutions required the issuing of marriage licenses to homosexual couples. The court could also use this to require the elimination of unisex insurance. Women would no longer be eligible for lower rates, even though they have longer life expectancies and have fewer accidents. So the ERA would give women the right to pay higher insurance premiums. And it could be argued that this could force the state to integrate male and female prison populations. Some may laugh at that, but it was interesting. And when the ERA was pushed nationally back in the 1970s, there was a book put out entitled Sex Bias in the U.S. Code, a report of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in 1977. And they made some of these same arguments as to the implications of the ERA. And in fact, they were supporting these implications. I think it's interesting, the experience of Wisconsin and Minnesota on the ERA, I think it's instructive. Many years ago in Wisconsin, language was added preventing the ERA from mandating abortion funding and special rights based on sexual orientation. The sponsors of that ERA in Wisconsin opposed the bill, or the supporters of that bill in Wisconsin then opposed the bill. And in Minnesota in 1983, the ERA was made abortion neutral. The sponsor of the bill then withdrew that ERA bill. So among other things, this clearly implicates the abortion and the marriage issues. And I'd finally say that there really isn't I think the more the public finds out about the ERA, the less they support it. In fact, when it's been brought up for referendum votes throughout the number of decades, it's generally failed. So for those reasons, we oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Any questions for these two witnesses? Thank you. Thank you both very much. And I want to thank all the people who made the time to be here today to provide information to the committee on this subject. I think that the information from both sides have been very useful and thoughtful and thought-provoking, and we will take that under consideration. So thank you all very much for being here. Any further discussions on this bill, members? Senator Cohen, you have the last word.
Well, Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for paying attention to the witnesses. Obviously, issues have been raised that will need to be addressed as this committee hopefully considers this at greater length during next year's session. But I think certainly the testimony from witnesses relative to why we should do this was quite compelling in suggesting that on the surface we would think in calendar year 2010 possibly this has become an anachronism, but clearly has not. And I think the testimony offered that illustration. We'll have the chance to elaborate on that in the months and next year's session. And certainly appreciate the chance to bring this issue once again in front of this committee after after many years of inaction. Obviously not – when I say inaction, I mean, as I suggested at the outset, looking for the right opportunity. And certainly appreciate, Madam Chair, your willingness to do so along with committee members' willingness to listen.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Members, we will move to the last item on our agenda for today. It is Senate File 3326, Senator Latz's bill. Senator Latz is stuck in court, I understand, and can't make it to join us. But
if we give shorter arguments.
Since this is a informational hearing only, we're going to go ahead and members, you have the bill before you. I think what I will do is I will have Mr. Hasse is here, and maybe perhaps, Mr. Hasse, you could walk us through the bill a little bit, and then we'll have the testifiers come and give us information and take questions. Mr. Hasse.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for making time for this important issue today, and I also want to extend our thanks to Senator Latz, who I know wanted to be here. My name is Mark Hasse. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Council on Crime and Justice, and the Council is a member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which has been doing a lot of the work on this legislation this session. Before I go into the I'll go through the bill quick, and then I have a couple comments about where it is in the process. Basically, what this does, and some of our testifiers will go into more description of what it does and why, but it just requires that the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission do a racial impact screening and, in some cases, statement of all legislation that may have an impact on the racial composition of the criminal offender population. I would rather than go into the details of the language, I think it's better to have the testifiers describe what this does and why, and then take questions as that comes up. One of the testifiers is Ms. Suzanne Allegro, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and she can speak more to what they currently do and what else needs to be done. And that brings me to one reason that we didn't this legislation didn't go through more quickly this session or start earlier is that there are some issues with the data collection. Senator Moore, I know you understand that in collecting racial data, that can sometimes be problematic. So we hope that this is the beginning of a conversation that will bring people together to come back next year. And we didn't want to push it too fast if we didn't have the procedures in place to make this happen. So this is a start of that conversation to figure out how we can get the right data to do this. With that, I think I'd like to introduce the testifiers. Right, Madam Chair?
Yes. Please.
We have with us today Sarah Walker, who is the Chief Operating Officer of 180 Degrees and a founding organizer with the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. Freddie Davis English is the Disparate Minority Contact Chair of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, and she has 37 years of experience in juvenile corrections, from line staff to being the Hennepin County Juvenile Detention Center Supervisor. or superintendent. Judge Gary Bastian of Ramsey County District Court is the past co-chair of the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative and former presiding judge of the Juvenile Court. And again, Suzanne Allegro is the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you again, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Walker.
Thank you. Ms. Walker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And thank you again, Madam Chair and the committee, for allowing us this opportunity. And we'll do our best to be as brief as possible. As all of you know, the principle of impartial justice is a cornerstone of American democracy. What racial impact statements are a tool developed to estimate the unequal racial impacts of criminal justice policies in the same way that fiscal or environmental impact statements describe the budgetary and or ecological effects of other policies. This allows legislators to make an informed consideration of racial impacts when crafting solutions to crime and delinquency and help ensure that racial justice costs are included in the public dialogue regarding criminal justice policies. There's little question today that extreme racial disparities exist in our criminal justice systems. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that nationally 17% of African American men and 8% of Latino male will be incarcerated at some point in their life, compared to 2.6% of white men. States in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest have the highest rates of racial disparity. Disparities in the criminal justice system result from a complex set of factors, but among them are most certainly sentencing and drug policies that produce disproportionate racial and ethnic effects. More than two decades ago, Congress mandated longer prison sentences for abusers of crack cocaine than for those who abuse the powder version. The result, of course, as we all know, was the dramatic increase of African-American incarceration. Recognizing its error, however belatedly, Congress recently reversed itself. Minnesota showed its leadership over 15 years ago by eliminating this unwarranted and unscientific distinction between powdered and crack cocaine. Both the Minnesota and U.S. action were triggered by the undeniably unequal impact those laws had on African-Americans. Had racial impact statements been part of this legislative process, many of these effects would have been anticipated prior to the policies that were put in place and may have resulted in different alternative policy choices. Once legislation is enacted, as you all know, it's very difficult to change. In order to avoid unwarranted disparities within the criminal justice system, policymakers should weigh the potential racial impact of proposed sentencing legislation, and one means to do this is by adopting racial impact statements. Impact statements allow the legislature to anticipate the unwarranted disparities and to consider the alternative policies that could accomplish the goals of the proposed legislation without creating any disparate impact, or at least unavoidable disparate impact. And why should Minnesota do this? They should do this because in 2006, Minnesota's ranked fifth in the nation for racial disparities in incarceration. In addition, it ranks 13th highest for people under supervision for racial disparities. On average, in Minnesota, 9 African Americans are incarcerated for every 1 Caucasian American male. And in 1978, the Minnesota prison population was approximately 12% African American. Today, it's fast approaching 50%. These disparities also persist. They're endemic in our juvenile justice system. Today, in both Ramsey and Hennepin County, the juvenile disparity rates hovers at around 85%. And these lopsided trends also impact our out-of-home placement, where most youth are referred from our juvenile justice system, where Minnesota ranks the 7th highest in the nation for racial disparity. In recent national polls, over 50% of Americans agreed that it is extremely important that we not tolerate a criminal justice system that is unfair to racial and ethnic minorities. In that same poll, over 70% believed that individuals were not treated fairly in the criminal justice system regardless of race or circumstance. Our justice system cannot function without the trust and confidence of the citizens it is meant to serve. Proactively identifying disparities will increase the trust and therefore the efficacy of our justice system. The original legislation creating the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines mandates that sentences should be impartial with respect to race and status. It also requires that guidelines should be proportional and take into substantial consideration the prison capacity. Minnesota's Sentencing Guidelines Commission is a national leader in evaluating racial impacts for felony-level offenses. Its work is considered a model for other Midwestern states that have recently adopted the use of racial impact statements. In 2009, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Connecticut began using racial impact statements. At the time their legislation was passed, Iowa ranked the highest for racial disparities, and Connecticut ranked fourth highest for racial disparities. And unfortunately, Minnesota is not far behind with a ranking of fifth. States currently considering legislation include Oregon, Illinois, and Texas. In Minnesota, in 2009, through bipartisan efforts, the Disproportionate Minority Contact Act was passed. Racial impact statements strengthen and support the legislation passed in 2009. Minnesota's population is growing more diverse each year. Demographers estimate that by 2030, more than 50% of the population will be people of color. And we've all heard about the collateral impact of involvement in the justice system. Failure to consider these unequal impacts in criminal justice policy will not only impact the individuals caught in the system, but threaten some of the social and civic and economic fabric of our communities across the state. Racial impact statements do not tie the hands of policymakers, but they support our increased move towards adopting evidence-based decision-making in public policy. Racial impact statements are a straightforward way to move the debate on these critical issues to the forefront of criminal justice policy development. Thank you.
Ready? Thank you, Ms. Walker. Any questions for this witness? Thank you very much. Ms. Freddie Davis English, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good to see you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Moore, and committee members. My name is Freddie Davis English, and I appear before you today representing the Minnesota State Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, that's better known as JJAC. JJAC is a governor-appointed committee, for those of you who don't know, that reports to the governor and the legislature on the well-being of juveniles in the state of Minnesota, also looking at the trends and opportunities for improvement in the juvenile justice system in our various communities. And we also support improved public safety for all. I serve as the subcommittee chair for JJAC on the DMC committee, DMC, better known as Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee. And our committee has, over the past years, supported the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, that is to reduce the number of youth that do not have to be in detention, which is very costly. I was there at one point. And also in looking at which factors increase the population of minorities in a various sections of the juvenile justice system. Last session, after a year and a half of collaborating with numerous professional organizations around the state and consulting with national justice representatives, JJAC worked to establish a statewide policy regarding DMC. With the policy, we supported all state agencies to collaborate and provide available data on DMC within these systems to JJAC, so that we may gather and research pertinent statistical information and other documentation in support of statewide DMC. Minnesota continues compliance with the four core protections, and those are the four protections that we are bound by through the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Are committed to work with county and local jurisdictions to explore ways to collect and report accurate DMC data. And with that, we are here to support the racial impact statement. And as you know, last year, in 2009, Minnesota State Legislature passed and Governor Pelosi signed into law on May 11th the policy. And I always like to, we use it to remind ourselves of what we're working for, that the state of Minnesota to identify and eliminate barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness within the criminal justice system, juvenile justice, corrections, and judicial systems in support of the fundamental principle of fair and equitable treatment under law. And that's what we're here, as I said, to support this law, and as well as this is our guide for the Juvenile Justice Advisory DMC Committee. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? All right, we'll move on along to our next witness. Judge Bastian, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee, Madam Chair.
good news for you is that I had a hearing and I was running late, so my prepared remarks are left on my desk. I'm going to be much briefer than I probably could be. We have been involved in Ramsey County District Court, the Juvenile Division, with the JDAI process, and that's the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. And we've also had a grant that includes the DMC. Some people say disproportionate minority confinement. Some say disproportionate minority contacts. The process itself, and it was surprising to me, we were in it since 2005, is that we had to pull statistics to know what we were doing. And we had a county attorney computer system. We had a police department computer system. We had a Department of Community Corrections computer system. And during this process, the state court Mensis system was implemented. They don't talk to each other. And you can't push a button and get the information. So what we've been able to do is, in some instances, when we were looking at particular issues like probation violations, Department of Corrections up there had to go and actually pull all the files for a particular year and so that we knew what we were doing. What it comes down to is that you need the information. You need to break it down by what you do. In juvenile process in particular, you can have it decisions made before the child even comes into juvenile court. The police can decide to send it to diversion, or they can refer it to the county attorney for charging. It gets to the county attorney, they can divert it. It gets to district court, the court can make a decision on whether to hold or not hold the child, whether to adjudicate or not adjudicate, whether to do other things with the child and put them on supervised or unsupervised probation. But if you're doing that and you're looking at the impact you have on the kids that are coming into court, you have to do a decision point analysis, which is a fancy way of looking at each particular step along the process and say, are they doing things that are racially motivated, or you don't know they're racially motivated. It's just happening because it's been the general practice. So anything you do from a policy point of view to look at the numbers, I know the chair has been very involved in what we're doing in Ramsey County. And I'm going to end my testimony just to encourage you, as a policy matter, get the statistics so you know what you're doing, no matter what district we're in. The Mensis system is going to pull out numbers for us. We just have to program what we need. So our system will be able to eventually pull out what we do. But as you look at the four steps along the way, we're not quite that clear. That's what I have to tell you today.
Thank you, Judge Bastian. Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Allegra, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I'm going to talk a little bit about the experience that the Guidelines Commission has had with racial impact notes and also talk a little bit about the legislation. Beginning in 2007, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission thought it appropriate to begin providing the legislature racial impact notes on proposed felony crime bills in addition to the fiscal notes the commission has always provided. By doing so, as has been mentioned, Minnesota became the first state in the nation to prepare estimates of racial impact that affect sentencing and corrections policy for legislators. Subsequently, both Connecticut and Iowa enacted laws requiring such estimates and used Minnesota's notes as patterns. Just as with the Commission's fiscal notes, the agency does not comment on whether or not a particular bill should be enacted, but rather it is setting out facts that may be useful to the legislature, whose members express concerns about the disparity between the number of minorities in our population and the number in prisons. Racial impact statements are important because, as has been mentioned, it's exceedingly difficult to reverse sentencing policies once they've been adopted. The process that we follow to date is to first screen new crime legislation to determine if the legislation would affect the racial composition of the criminal offender population. This is done by looking at the racial characteristics of the offender population for a given offense. If the commission staff finds that the legislation will have an impact, the staff provides a racial impact statement, and it is forwarded to the chair of the appropriate committee. The racial impact notes have included information on the percentages for the racial composition of Minnesota's population according to the U.S. Census, and for comparison purposes, percentages of the racial makeup of the felony offender population as well as its prison population. The notes then describe the impact the proposed legislation would have on the percentages by race of persons who would go to prison and any increase or decrease in the length of sentence. Additionally, the amount of jail time and increase or decrease in probation caseloads is also provided. The Commission does not have access to data on local corrections programs to which an offender might be sentenced or numbers in drug, DWI, or mental health courts. In preparing the racial impact notes, as with the fiscal impact notes, it is obviously easier to estimate the proposed impact if the legislation changes an existing offense. If the legislation proposes a new offense, it is difficult to estimate the impact, as it is unknown how many numbers of persons might be charged, what the makeup will be of the offender population, and percentage of departure rates. Since the racial impact notes have begun in 2007, we have not had much experience in preparing them. And this is basically because, as you know, during the last few years, given the state's current fiscal situation, there has not been much legislation passed that would increase penalties and would result in an increased prison bed impact. Current bill is, as you know, since we have started doing racial impact notes on our own, we do support the concept of racial impact notes. However, the way the bill is currently drafted, we would be responsible for preparing racial impact notes on all criminal offenses. We do not have sentencing data on gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor offenses, nor do we have victim information. I agree that all crime legislation should be looked at to determine the racial impact, but we are not in a position to provide information on non-felony offenses. Additionally, some of the impact of crime legislation is not on prison population, but more directly affects local correction program resources, which again is important data to collect. However, the mechanics of collecting this information may be difficult, and we may not be the best agency to coordinate the collection process. It is also a little unclear as to the mechanics of how the racial impact notes will be sent to the legislature according to the legislation. As you know, there is a system currently in place for the posting of fiscal notes. I'm not sure whether the legislation contemplates a similar system be set up, or if the expectation is we would continue just to forward the fiscal impact notes to the chair of the appropriate committee. One other area, Minnesota and Iowa have focused the use of racial impact notes on sentencing and state corrections policy, while Connecticut, in addition to sentencing and corrections policy, also looks at the pretrial population. As such, Minnesota and Iowa racial impact focus on the back end of the criminal process and do not take into account enforcement practices, pretrial release, plea bargaining, or prosecutorial discretion. At some point in the future, the goal may be to include the racial disparities at each step of the criminal process.
Ms. Allegro, I don't recall having actually looked at one of these racial impact statements, and I wonder if they've just escaped us, or if could you refresh our memory about the most recent racial impact statement that your office may have done?
Madam Chair, I think there was one done in 2007 concerning some penalties for aggravated robbery, I believe, and that was forwarded on. We did prepare last year, but we never sent it on because the legislation didn't move forward. A racial impact on the omnibus crime proposals that the Judiciary Committee had considered, and I think, as I said, we did prepare. We just never moved it forward because the legislation didn't move forward.
Ms. Legger, the racial impact statements that are done, is it sent to the budget divisions, or is it, it seems to be bed impact oriented, so if it piggybacks on the fiscal notes, it would seem that it would only go to the budget divisions, or does it also go to the policy chairs?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding it would go to the policy chairs as well as the budget chairs.
So if a set of criminal bills are coming before the committee, would I be able to make a request to your office to put together racial impact statements on those set of bills?
Madam Chair, yes, you would. I think the other thing I should point out, we have looked at, with some of the bills we have looked that have been introduced, we have looked at the racial impact, and we have determined that there will be no racial impact, and so we have not done anything. I think what this legislation contemplates is that we would then look, if that were the case, we would send a note to the committee chair saying we have looked at it and we've determined no racial impact, or if we have determined a racial impact, that would get moved forward. That's the step we're not doing now, is if we have looked at it and determined there isn't any, we're not informing the committee chair.
So, Mr. Legger, how much more onerous would it be, or how much different is what is being proposed in the bill from what you're currently doing?
Madam Chair, it wouldn't be onerous on to send the statement saying that we have looked at the bill and determined that there's no racial impact. That would not be a problem for us. I think the concern that I have and the staff has is more in that it asks for all crime legislation, and we do not have access to felony or gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor, so we're not in a position to provide that. But for the felony crime bills, we would certainly be able to send the note saying we have looked at it and determined no impact.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I can see a practical problem here. First of all, they would have to be preparing the note based upon the bill as it was introduced. Mm-hmm. Because if an author comes to the committee and starts, having a delete all amendment or whatever, that they wouldn't have any time to respond to that. And plus two, they almost would have to be preparing notes on every single bill that's introduced, because they don't know which of those myriad of bills are going to be selected to be heard. I think that's why one of the reasons fiscal notes are not prepared for the policy committees, not because we don't have an interest in them, but it isn't until the bill actually leaves the policy committees that you can actually, the fiscal analyst can look at the note and figure out, okay, here's what it says, and have the impact prepared by the time it actually gets to the Finance Committee. So I think that, there may be some practical problems trying to get the information here unless there's better communication saying, okay, here's the bills we're going to look at, and, look at the language as it is, and, we're not, don't assume any amendments, which is a big leap.
So, Senator Betzel, I think that, but there certainly is an interest. I guess it would differ from committee chair to committee chair, but certainly in this committee, because it's a critical tool and it's something that's of value. I think one way that we could get around that is that bills will not be scheduled for a hearing until the authors get a racial impact statement. Or through the committee, the authors have also requested a racial impact statement, which means that their bills would have to be in shape. And that there will not be a delete everything amendment, and that if they're going to come to the committee with the delete everything amendment, that the racial impact statement would be on that delete everything amendment.
Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, hypothetically, what if, say, the Judiciary Committee amends a bill, which could happen?
That's true, and I think that would be part of the discussion. I mean, because then it would change the dynamic of the racial impact statement. Just as I think in the divisions, the committee changes bills that affects the price tag. Senator Higgins and then Senator Lemire. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm interested in this. I'm wondering whether Ms. Allegro has copies of statements from other states that, we could look at. I'm sitting here trying to figure out how you set up your assumptions without starting with an assumption
that people of one race would create this crime or possibly is be arrested for this crime or convicted of this crime more often than people of another race. And that's a problematic assumption to start out with. And so I'm just really curious to see how this works in other states.
Ms. Allegro?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, as I mentioned, it's there's really two ways that crime legislation obviously could be. You could either change an existing law, either increase a penalty or decrease it. And that's when I said before that if it's an existing crime, we would have the racial characteristics and we would be able to do the racial impact statement based on the existing offender population for that offense. What is difficult, as I mentioned before, is if it's a new offense, you're correct that you really don't know with a brand new offense what the makeup of the offender population for the new offense would be.
Senator Higgins, though, I want to hear your comment, but building on that, I think that the interesting dilemma that this presents to us is some of the challenges that we currently encounter with the current fiscal notes, because it's based on what the status quo is. So what I'm hearing Ms. Allegro say is that if we change, let's say, the penalty for a crime that for which you currently have statistics, mm-hmm. all you would know is under current law, this is the breakdown of the demographics we have of people who are incarcerated right now. And if you change the penalty by reducing it or increasing it, this is how we are projecting that it would affect this population that we already have who are incarcerated. But it's not helpful from, I think, what Senator Limmer and I often talk about is it doesn't capture the unintended consequences if we create a new penalty. I think Ms. Allegro's capacity to generate the racial impact statement doesn't allow her, I think, to capture the full picture of what some of the unintended adverse consequences would be in that racial impact statement. So do you want to follow up with your question?
Madam Chair, I was just... I guess the data set that you would have would be the people who are currently incarcerated,
right.
As you just said. I can surely see the value of it, but I'm trying to pick my words carefully. I'm wondering if it won't lay us open to the same sorts of criticisms that we have been criticizing other people about for many years, making assumptions about people based on the color of their skin. And I'm having a little trouble with that. And maybe Ms. Walker or Mr. Hazy, who have been working in this field for a long time, can give some advice.
Ms. Walker?
Yes, well, Senator Higgins, thank you. And I think it's a very good question. One, I would just say this is the same way basically that all statistical data is analyzed based on what current projection trends are. It's not any different than what demographers do in anticipating the change in minority population. And some of those assumptions that go into that are based on things that we would call that have significant racial overtones to them. But I'd also say that what's happening now is that we're basically producing the same outcome without the conversation. And this is really about interjecting that conversation on the front end of it. I would just like to go back to what I said earlier, is that there are instances in which we know, there's other things that we know, is that we knew that, for instance, with crack and powder cocaine, that the majority of African-American users were using crack, and Caucasian users, even though the numbers were about the same, if you switch the type of drug, they were the same. So it was one of those cases, very obvious racial disparate impact, that you could have looked at alternatives.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an interesting discussion and complex because we're focusing on the front end of how we write law. And trying to determine in advance if it has an unequal application. And yet once one gets involved in a criminal justice system, there's a lot of influences that go into the final outcome of a sentence or a conviction. One could have an over-aggressive prosecutor role. One could have a different degree of criminal defense that might be available to the defendant. One may have an amenable judge that would accept a plea bargain versus a judge that would not like to consider a certain plea bargain over something else. You've got the aggressiveness of law enforcement trying to pursue or prevent a certain behavior, and by their enforcement in a certain area of the state, they may use it as their policing as an example for the community to realize they want to stop a certain behavior. And then you've got just the behavior of what triggers the probable cause, and could it be actually the defendant, triggering all of that going on. So trying to assess a racial impact, I'd like to see how it works. And in light of all of the other elements in the trail that eventually gets to this disproportionate population of confinement. And I think there's probably, one could write a racial impact statement on every element along that trail in order to get a real accurate picture of what it is versus, is it just the action of the defendant who actually gets convicted of a real crime?
Yes.
So, it's a complex thing.
Ms. Walker?
I totally agree that the reasons for disparities exist at every single point of the justice system, and this is just one portion of a solution or potential way to look at this. I guess I would also say that if you read the legislation, what it says is it doesn't say we have to use these. And so we could, there are disparities that might be warranted. One of the things that Chief Harrington frequently says when we're working with him on the JDI is that also the majority of victims tend to be people of color, and we know that crime tends to be follow same race victim patterns. So there are times, for instance, that there are disparities that might have a legitimate reason, like you said, the behavior of the offender. This doesn't remove accountability from the offender, but it, again, I would just say that like the recent MCORP study, we're all supposed to be moving towards evidence-based practices, and this is one of the ways to do that. I do think there's large-scale implications for not considering it. I doubt any of us really want to remain in the top rank for racial disparities within our justice system, but it is certain that as the population grows more diverse, the implications for criminal record and justice system involvement and the cost of this are pretty large.
You know, Selma, I think that it's interesting. Oftentimes the debate with respect to the racial and, to a large extent, the gender conversation tends to be a struggle between the two words that you mentioned, which is the unequal application, and that there's a certain presumption that because of a certain result that there has to have been an unequal application, and vice versa, to say, well, just because there is a disproportionate result, it doesn't always imply an unequal application. And I think that the idea of these screening tools and these assessment tools is to say, let's put a tool in place. And to the extent that the tool could be used by the actors who have to exercise discretion in how they apply the law, that perhaps the tool then can act to moderate the behavior. And I don't think that at the end of the day, what has been so profoundly interesting from the JDI experience is that we hear over and over from the people who work in the field, and you've all heard since we've had a committee here on that, is that social workers and law enforcement are police officers saying, I thought I was kind of doing a really good job until I was using this assessment tool,
which doesn't mean that I'm a bad person and that I have bad intentions. It's just that in the culture of what we do, we just do things according to a certain pattern. And the value in this assessment tool is that it kind of interrupted my pattern of behavior and made me think about doing my job in a different way, because the tool acts as a reminder. So what I find interesting about this assessment tool is that, in a way, it doesn't necessarily dictate how police officers apply the law or how judges apply the law. But actually what this assessment tool does is that it's the screening tool for us as policymakers to moderate our patterns of behavior as we think about making public policies and its unintended consequences on the public. I think that's where the value of this is that it doesn't necessarily or shouldn't lead to us dictating to how people out there apply the law. But it is at least from Ms. Allegro's standpoint, and the value to me as a committee chair and to us as committee members is that I think that it acts to sort of check the way we think and the way we discuss and the way we make decisions and the policies that come before this committee before it even gets out there to be applied, to be implemented. Thereby, there's a certain value to what you alluded to earlier, which is that once we are successful in coming up with a tool in this arena, then obviously the desire is to move towards how we put that tool in place as the specific policies get implemented out in the public, so that not only do we capture that discussion here, but we're also able to capture that discussion out in the public as the laws are being implemented. And so where I find the value to the racial impact screening is not necessarily in how it changes behavior out there, but how it changes our behavior as policymakers as we contemplate and debate the potential, the real and the intended and unintended consequences of the policies that we make. And I think that's where the value in this comes in.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pearsall?
I'm thinking about this tool, and it does probably have a lot of value in many hands at the right time and for the right purposes. But sometimes when you have so many tools, you start relying on one or two, and pretty soon it drives the decision. Mm-hmm. And then you may create terrible imbalances that would be unjust or something. So I'm not sure sometimes of which tool to reach for.
Sure.
And so this one is one that I'm wondering about here. Mm-hmm. Gives me more pause for thought.
Well, I can say,
Ms. Walker?
Because the impact statements are relatively new concept and they were first implemented in 2009, there's only one state that we're aware of currently that we know has used them. And though, I guess there's a few things. One is that if you only apply the tool for proposed legislation that gets a hearing, what they found is there's only one bill in Connecticut that this actually applied to. So one, that reduces the amount of times it's actually going to be used. But in the Connecticut example, it's my understanding that it was about school zoning and drug use. And one of the things that they found, which actually did totally alter the debate, and which I would argue in a significant way, was that because individuals, especially in urban communities, it was about increased sentences for area within the drugs, you know, the school safe zones. And so individuals who were dealing drugs within that area tend to live in that community in urban areas, and so people in urban areas were much more likely to have increased penalties, whereas people in suburban communities where the drug use was actually about the same were less likely just due to the geographic area. So they did make some adjustments based on that.
Interesting.
Any other discussions?
This is fascinating, Madam Chair.
Well, I mean, that's why I think that even though, you know, the session has ended and the deadlines are gone, I felt like it was really important to bring this bill to our attention and something for us to think about. And in the interim, I think that it might, you know, it might be something that if the committee is interested, we should bring in some people from those states who have had these experiences to talk to us about how they're using it and how it has in some way been helpful or not helpful in how they make public policy. But I certainly think that, you know, the work that we do here is so critical and affects people's lives in such fundamental ways that we owe a responsibility to the people of the state of Minnesota to really look at how we could bring in tools to help us be better and more thoughtful decision makers. Ms. Allegro, you have been very helpful. Thank you very much for your input on this. And personally, to me, I look forward to continuing to work with you on this, because I think that this is very important, not only to the members of this committee, but I think to the legislature as a body.
Madam Chair, absent the legislation, you can always ask us to prepare an impact statement, or Senator Higgins, for your committee if you want us to.
And we will take you up on that. Thank you very much. Any further discussions, members? I want to thank you all very much for making the time to come to these two hearings. I think that sometimes members, just because we don't vote on a specific piece of legislation doesn't mean that it's not important or critical. And in fact, the times when we don't necessarily take a vote in this committee actually are times when we're contemplating issues that are even more critical to members of the public. And I think that this day is one of those days, and I want to personally thank you all for making the time to be here. The committee is adjourned.
Now, if she said gender,